Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, your show about parks, public land, politics, policy, anything else that starts with the letter P today. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver. On the show today, New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich returns. We will talk to him about the big public lands bill that is now waiting for the president's signature. Plus, we will head to White Sands, New Mexico for this week in Western history with a record-breaking rocket launch 70 years ago. But first, let's do the news. There is growing congressional pressure on Acting Interior Secretary David Bernhardt. A deadline from the House Natural Resources Committee for Bernhardt to produce his calendars came and went last Friday with no sign of them. Then this week, Senators Richard Blumenthal and Elizabeth Warren fired off a pair of letters to Interior's Inspector General and top ethics official, requesting both an investigation and a whole pile of documents relating to Bernhardt's actions to help Westland's Water District. You'll remember that's a former client of Bernhardt's and a vocal opponent of endangered species protections. You'll recall that last month, the New York Times reported that Bernhardt went ahead and issued orders that would harm the Delta smelt, an endangered fish that needs enough water getting to the San Francisco Bay. Bernhardt claimed that he got a verbal okay from ethics officials to do that. Senators Warren and Blumenthal zero in on that verbal okay in their document request. They are looking for all the memos and notes that ethics officials took. They're trying to figure out if Bernhardt has been giving those officials enough information to make informed decisions in the first place. There is just a two-week deadline on that request, so expect things to come to a head quickly, especially since President Trump still hasn't submitted Bernhardt's name to the Senate for confirmation as Interior Secretary. Now, Bernhardt's troubles may not end there. The Washington Post reports that a grand jury is looking into whether former Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke lied to federal investigators. They're looking at Zinke's decision to not allow two tribes to open a casino in Connecticut. That is a decision that MGM Casinos, a competitor, lobbied hard for. Now, how does Bernhardt fit into all this? Well, MGM is a former client of his lobbying firm, and Bernhardt is not supposed to have anything to do with them. But at least twice in 2017, right around the same time this was all going on with the casino decision, Bernhardt did meet with MGM lobbyists. He insists MGM never came up, but one of those lobbyists, the former Interior Secretary Gail Norton, wasn't registered to lobby Interior on behalf of any other clients besides MGM. She was apparently just there to make small talk. So it was a remarkable sequence of totally unrelated meetings in which David Bernhardt definitely did not talk about the thing that the lobbyists cared about most at the time they took the meetings. Got that? All right. Also, that giant public lands bill that we talked about in detail last week did, as expected, pass the House by a huge bipartisan margin. That bill does include a permanent reauthorization of the Land and Water Conservation Fund. That means the bill is now sitting on President Trump's desk waiting for a signature as he flies back from Vietnam. No word on when the president plans to sign it, but given that it passed both chambers by an easy veto-proof margin, the president doesn't have much choice. Go back one episode in your feed for an awesome conversation with the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society about what's in that bill, what didn't make the cut, and why it's all such a big deal. Our guest today is the junior senator from the great state of New Mexico. He's a former U.S. House member and city councilman in Albuquerque. And more importantly, he is the first senator to show up twice here on Go West Young Podcast. Senator Martin Heinrich, thank you so much for coming back.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
So first off, congratulations on passing the public lands bill. That is a very big deal.
A lot of years of effort. Like, goodness knows how many years between, you know, people who work on these projects all across the country go into a single bill like that. But I'm sure it's an incalculable number.
What does it mean for the state of New Mexico in terms of what's in it?
You know, for the state of New Mexico, it's kind of the culmination of several decades of effort by communities in different parts of the states to protect as well as promote the things that they really care about in their backyards. You know, for years I worked with the Obama administration and local communities in the north and far south of my state to create two new national monuments. But there were pieces of that vision with regard to wilderness that can only be designated by Congress. And so a lot of wilderness study areas and other proposed wilderness that had really been, you know, people had organized around for 25 plus years, you know, all of that came together and was made real with this legislation.
Truly decades of work. It's impressive. And we'll get back to national monuments in a second, but I want to kind of head up to the 30,000 foot view here. The bill passed the Senate 92-8. It passed the House 363-62. It is rare these days to find anything in Congress with that kind of broad bipartisan support. Do you think that says something about how the politics of public lands have changed over the last few years?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, there was a time, I think if we were debating the same bill 10 years ago, you would not have seen anything like those numbers. And, you know, there was a long period of time where it was sort of in fashion to try to get rid of the public lands, to privatize the public lands. There were whole think tanks who spent large portions of their budgets and their time on very anti-public land policy. And I think it's pretty remarkable that we find ourselves, even some of the people I served with in the House of Representatives 10 years ago, 8 years ago, who introduced incredibly hostile legislation towards our public lands, were on the floor lauding what a great bill this was, how important our public lands are, how important they are for our economies and for local communities. It really is a shift in a relatively short amount of time.
Put that in the context, then, of what happened in New Mexico last November. Obviously, you won re-election, but we saw the governor's seat, we saw a congressional seat flip. Was it a blue wave or more of a green wave in your state, do you think?
You know, it was different than previous elections in that in this election cycle, public lands were a major issue, and not just at the federal level. So people were running on the issue of protecting our public lands for Congress, for statewide offices like governor and land commissioner, all the way down to a whole series of new state representatives that were elected to the state house. It was remarkable how ubiquitous it was for those candidates to actually be making public lands a big part of their campaign and their platforms and even their advertising. We really hadn't seen that in New Mexico in the past. You'd see it in isolated cases, and certainly it's always been an issue that was really central to who I am as a former outfitter guide and something that I care deeply about. But this time it was really across the board.
Do you think that there's a lesson for other states here, or is what happened in New Mexico unique to New Mexico in that way?
Well, I think if you look at where a number of my Republican Senate colleagues were successful in around the West as well, it's beginning to be an issue that is really bringing people together on both sides of the aisle. And I think it's in the past, it had been more of a partisan issue, but I think we're now seeing a public that woke up to the fact that this birthright of hundreds of millions of amazing acres of land that they own was not a foregone conclusion, that that could be taken away by Congress, that that access to that could be denied. And when the public woke up to that, the response to that, I think, has been very strong, and it's been across the political spectrum. Groups from, you know, relatively culturally conservative groups like sportsmen to urban folks in some of the new city centers in the West, across the board, you really had an engaged public around these issues and standing up for the places they care about.
So you have this new slate of elected officials who campaigned and won on public lands and outdoor platforms. Now they're in office. It's time for the rubber to hit the road. Are you talking to all of these new elected officials about their priorities, and how do you translate that into policy, both at the federal and the state level?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, in New Mexico, we're in the middle of our 60-day legislative session right now. Obviously, we've started a new congressional session in Washington, D.C. And the public land package that just passed is really kind of the icing on this on the cake for the work of the last decade or more. But now is the time to really begin nailing down the work for the next wave of legislation that carries that forward. And that's a continuous process that typically is driven very locally and percolates its way up. And we're seeing that also not just at the, you know, in federal land protection legislation or things like the Land and Water Conservation Fund becoming permanent, but we're also seeing this push towards creating offices of outdoor recreation in various states around the West. New Mexico is considering legislation to do that in their legislative session right at the moment. We've seen Utah and Colorado do that. So it's something that, you know, the places where the next wave, the next chapter of policy gets written, that story is active right now. And I'm excited to see what these new elected office holders bring to the table, what their priorities are, both in terms of policy and in the places that they want to have an impact on.
Obviously, the public lands bill that passed is a huge victory, but the congressional session is still young. What are you looking forward to this session that you think there's still the possibility of getting through on outdoor or public lands issues?
I actually think that there are a number of things that we may be able to have sort of a second bite at the apple. I could certainly see another package coming together. There are always things that are just not quite ready, and oftentimes it takes years to get the details just right to where something's, you know, ready for prime time and ready to go across the finish line. I'm continuing to work on issues in my state that just weren't ready for this package yet, including some potential new national park designations. So I suspect that's probably true throughout the West and even in communities up and down the East Coast, places like North Carolina, where national forests are such a big deal. And I think it's going to be important for us to realize that, you know, you have this sentiment for a moment, and it may be there 5 years from now, it may not. We really owe it to our kids and our grandkids to make the most of it.
So you mentioned national monuments a couple minutes ago. The last time you were on the podcast was, in fact, the day after President Trump issued his proclamation that attempted to shrink Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante national monuments. You called that, quote, an embarrassment at the time. That's obviously all tied up in court. Since then, the Trump administration hasn't tried to shrink any other monuments, but Ryan Zinke did single out some of the monuments you worked on, Rio Grande del Norte, Oregon Mountains, Desert Peaks, as monuments that he thought needed amended proclamations and presidential orders. Have you heard anything since then from the Trump administration or from Acting Secretary Bernhardt about what they might try to do there, or have they finally been scared off and are going to keep their hands off national monuments?
I really think with regard to New Mexico, at least, it became incredibly clear to former Secretary Zinke that there was not the sentiment to support changes to those monuments. And even though those were sort of rolled out in a list of places, that quickly that sort of faded to the back burner and possibly even just off the stove for them. I think his visits to New Mexico, where it was overwhelming, the amount of support for those places, were, I think, were instructive and helpful in creating that dynamic. And then, you know, the legislation that we have just passed also, because it designates the roadless portions of those monuments as wilderness, really, I think, effectively protects some of the potential abuses that we could have seen under the kind of language that was discussed at that time. Talk of new rights of way and new developments across some of these areas. I think it would be very hard to do that in the case of Rio Grande del Norte National Monument and Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument now that those places are permanently protected in statute, as well as having the monument to sort of tie them together.
Staying on David Bernhardt for just one second, in the news update at the top of the podcast, we talked about these letters that Senators Blumenthal and Warren just sent to the Inspector General and the top ethics official at Interior, asking for an investigation, documents around David Bernhardt's ethical conflicts. Over on the House side, we've seen Chairman Raul Grijalva asking for detailed schedules from Bernhardt. At some point, the White House presumably will submit Bernhardt's name for an official nomination. What do you think happens at that point? Should the Senate wait until these document requests come back? Is there a chance they plow ahead? What's your read on what that nomination process or fight looks like?
Well, you know, if history is any guide, and I think it probably is, the majority leader, I think, will move forward. He has been incredibly loyal to the president, even when the president has been disrespectful of the very issues of separation of powers and respect for the Constitution with regard to the power of the purse and emergency declaration. So I think Mitch McConnell moves forward. I think where we can really have some important impact is in the confirmation hearings for that position in particular, and in many of their other nominations. Their nominee for the EPA right now is just an absolute and utter embarrassment. We're putting the fox in charge of the hen house, as it were. And so I think it's incredibly important, even if we don't have the votes to win every battle that we take on, I think what is just as important is showing the American people that we're on their side. And these processes have a way of doing that and illustrating that to people, and that's really, really critical.
Real quickly, before you go, I want to ask, since you know New Mexico so well, you were a guide, you obviously have campaigned on it, what do you think is the most underappreciated outdoor spot in New Mexico? Obviously, you've got these spectacular national parks and monuments, but what are the places that people don't think of that they should think of going to when they come to your state?
You know, I would say oftentimes people look at a map and they go to the places that are on that map. There are some big blank spots on the map in New Mexico that are very worthy of people's outdoor time and attention. Our wilderness study areas, the Bureau of Land Management wilderness study areas that have not yet been designated, some of them are just absolutely spectacular. And so that's one of the places I would urge people to, if they want to spend some time in some really spectacular country in the land of enchantment, places like Continental Divide Wilderness Study Area, truly remarkable landscapes that do not get the kind of visitation and visitor pressure that you typically see in other states.
And you mentioned the possibility of new national park units. What are those that you're looking at if you're in a position to name them?
The one that is the furthest along right now, and we had legislation in the previous Congress and came close. Didn't quite get it across the finish line, but I will be reintroducing that legislation, and I think with a new member of Congress from southern New Mexico, may have a partner rather than an adversary, is White Sands, what we hope to be White Sands National Park. And that effort is really the outgrowth, once again, of local community saying, why isn't this already a national park? And really wanting this special place that is such a huge part of the brand of Southern New Mexico to get the attention and the respect it deserves nationally.
I got to tell you, your timing's great there. The history segment we're about to talk about is the first hypersonic flight in world history, happened this week at White Sands in 1949. So I appreciate it. It's a perfect tease. Senator Martin Heinrich, thank you again so much for your time and for coming back to the podcast. Very much appreciate it. And thank you for all the work you do in defense of our public lands.
It's a real pleasure. And, you know, it's important that when we do have these big developments that we get together and celebrate them.
All right, as promised, we'll wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. Blink and you will miss it. It was on a Thursday, February 24th, 1949. Sitting on a launch pad at the White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico, scientists had a German V-2 rocket brought to the U.S. after World War II. And sitting on top of that V-2 was another rocket, a slender little needle called the WAC Corporal. The scientists were trying something crazy, a two-stage rocket. Now, it wasn't clear if this would work. Four previous launches had failed. Either the first or the second stage didn't work, or the whole thing just blew up, which is what had happened the previous November. But scientists knew that both rockets worked on their own. A V-2 had previously reached 69 miles high. A WAC Corporal had previously reached 50 miles. Now, I want to stop and explain the name here. Early rocket programs in the U.S. were named after the enlisted ranks of the Army: recruit, private, corporal, sergeant, each of them getting bigger and bigger as they developed and went along. But then the rocket scientists came up with the idea for what is now known as a sounding rocket, a research rocket that is only designed to take measurements and perform experiments in flight. Well, that didn't fit the pattern of bigger and better. It was only 1 foot in diameter. It was only 24 feet long. So they named it the WAC after the Women's Army Corps. And so it was a WAC rocket destined to make history that day in New Mexico. The German V-2 first stage made it up to 100 miles high, hitting 3,500 miles an hour. Then the WAC Corporal lit up, accelerating to more than 5,000 miles an hour, reaching an altitude of 244 miles. That was a full 130 miles farther than the previous record of a single-stage V-2 rocket. The WAC Corporal that day became the first man-made object to reach hypersonic speeds, that is to say, more than five times the speed of sound. And scientists were surprised when a year later they found tail fragments of that record-breaking rocket in the desert near the launch site in White Sands. Now, when you hit Mach 5, there's no clap of thunder like when a plane breaks the sound barrier, but the physics involved does change dramatically. The vehicle surface starts to heat up because of friction and shock waves, so protecting against that heat becomes the principal design challenge for hypersonic vehicles. That flight in New Mexico that day proved it was possible, and it proved that multi-stage rockets were going to be the way to get to space. By 1962, just 13 years later, the Mercury rocket that launched John Glenn into orbit hit Mach 22. 7 years after that, the Saturn V rockets that sent the Apollo astronauts to the moon would hit Mach 30 on the way there, and the highest speed ever recorded for a manned vehicle came during the Apollo 10 flight on its way back from orbiting the moon, just shy of 25,000 miles an hour, or 32 times faster than the speed of sound. And the fastest man-made object in the universe, that is the Parker Solar Probe, launched just last year. It's currently making a series of passes around Venus and the Sun, getting closer and picking up speed each time. It is already traveling at 212,000 miles an hour, or Mach 277. On its closest passes around the Sun in 2024 and 2025, the Parker Solar Probe is expected to hit 430,000 miles per hour, 560 times the speed of sound, breaking the previous record, which was actually just held by the Juno probe that went to Jupiter. It'll break that record more than 2.5 times over. A race to go ever faster that started with the first hypersonic flight over the New Mexico desert 70 years ago this week in Western history. Well, that is it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. Thanks again to Senator Martin Heinrich for his time and his insight. Hey, if you enjoyed this episode, if you're a new listener, please go leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. That is the best way for new listeners to find us. We're also on Spotify, Google Play, TuneIn, Radio Public, wherever you find your podcasts. We're there. Drop us a line with your thoughts on this episode, on new episodes, on other people we ought to talk to. We're at podcast@westernpriorities.org. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode. In the meantime, I'm Aaron Weiss, and on behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks for listening.
I was looking outside and wondering, is Edwards the only place where we can land this thing?
I don't know, is it?
I mean, it seems I remember reading something about the shuttle landing in White Plains or something.
White Plains, Rudy, come on. It's in the middle of New York.
White Sands. White Sands, New Mexico. Columbia of 82 landed there because the strip at Edwards was too wet. It was a big emergency. Also, if we could make the window to White Sands, we can land there.